The windows were still hung with black. The only light came from candles, and the blank eyes of the statue stared at everyone who approached the throne itself. But now, their living, breathing model sat on the throne, resembling his stone copy so much that the dark hall seemed to Fenelia like a cabinet of mirrors. Cosimo was alone. Neither her ugliness nor her son were to be seen. There were only 6 guards standing in the background, almost invisible in the dim light. Fenelio stopped at a suitable distance from the steps up to the throne and bowed. Although it was his opinion that no one in this world or any other world deserved to have him, Fenelio, bow his head to them, certainly not to those whom his own words had called to life, nevertheless he, too, had to observe the rules of the game in this world of his own creation. Here it was as natural to bow to nobles dressed in silk and velvet as it had been to shake hands in his old world.
"Go on, then, old man, bow, even if it hurts your back," he thought, bending his head a little more humbly. "You fixed it this way yourself."
Cosimo examined him as if he were not sure whether he remembered his face. He was dressed entirely in white, which emphasized his likeness to the statues even more.
"You are the poet Fenelio, also known as the Inkweaver, is that so?"
Fenelio had imagined that voice would be rather fuller. Cosimo looked at the statues, letting his eyes wander from one to another.
"Someone recommended me to summon you. I believe it was my wife. She says you have the cleverest mind to be found between this castle and the Adderheads, and she thinks I shall need clever minds. But that's not why I called for you."
Violante? Violante had recommended him? Fenelio tried to hide his surprise.
"No? Why then, your grace?" he asked.
Cosimo's eyes rested on him abstractedly as if he were looking straight through him. Then he glanced down at himself, plucked at the magnificent tunic he wore, and adjusted his belt. "My clothes don't fit anymore," he observed. "They're all a little too long or too wide, as if they'd been made for those statues, and not for me." He smiled at Fenelio rather helplessly. It was the smile of an angel.
"You've been through a difficult time, your grace," said Fenelio.
"Yes, so I'm told. You see, I don't remember. There's very little I can remember at all. My head feels strangely empty."
He passed a hand over his brow and looked at the statues again.
"That's why I summoned you," he said. "They say you're a master of words, and I want you to help me to remember. I'm giving you the task of writing down everything there is to say about Cosimo. Get my soldiers to tell you, my servants, my old nurse, my wife."
He hesitated a moment before saying that last word.
"Balbulus will write your stories out and illuminate them, and then I'll have them read to me, to fill the empty space in my head and heart with words and images again. Do you think you can do it?"
Fenelio hastily nodded. "Yes, of course, your grace. I'll write it all down, stories of your childhood, when your worthy father was still alive, tales of your first rides through the wayless wood, everything about the day your wife came to this castle, and the day your son was born."
Cosimo nodded. "Yes, yes," he said, and there was relief in his voice. "Ah, I see you understand. And don't forget my victory over the fire raisers and the time I spent with the white women."
"I certainly will not."
Fenelio examined the handsome face as unobtrusively as possible. How could this have happened? He had been meant not just to believe that he was the real Cosimo, but to share all the dead man's memories too. Cosimo rose from the throne occupied by his father not so long ago and began pacing up and down.
"I've already been told several stories myself, by my wife."
Her ugliness again. Fenelio looked around for her.
Where is your wife?"
"Looking for my son. He ran away because I wouldn't receive his grandfather."
"If I may be so bold, your grace, why wouldn't you receive him?"
The heavy door opened behind Fenelio's back, and Tullio scurried in. He was no longer holding the dead bird as he crouched on the steps at Cosimo's feet, but fear still lingered on his face.
"I do not intend to ever receive him again."
Cosimo stopped in front of the throne and patted the emblem of his house.
"I have told the guards at the gate not to let my father-in-law into this castle another time, or any who serve him."
Tullio looked up at him in alarm and incredulity, as if he already felt the Adderhead's arrow in his own furry breast. But Cosimo, unmoved, was continuing,
"I have had myself informed of what went on in my realm while I—"
And he hesitated a moment before going on.
"While I was away, yes, let's call it that, away, I have listened to my administrators, head foresters, merchants and peasants, my soldiers, and my wife. In the process, I have learned some very interesting things, alarming things, and just imagine, poet, my father-in-law had something to do with almost every bad tale that I hear. Tell me, since I believe you go in and out of the strolling players' tents, what do the motley folk say about the Adderhead?"
"The motley folk," Fenelio cleared his throat. "What everyone says. They say he's very powerful. Perhaps rather too powerful."
Cosimo uttered a mirthless laugh. "Oh, yes, he is indeed. And? What was he getting at?"
"You should know, Fenelio," he told himself uneasily. "If you don't know what's going on in his head, then who does?" "Well, they say the Adderhead rules with an iron fist," he went on hesitantly. "There's no law in Argenta but his own word and his seal. He is vengeful and vain. He extorts so much from his peasants that they go hungry. He sends rebellious subjects to his silver mines, even children, until they're spitting blood clots in the depths. Poachers caught in his part of the forest are blinded. Thieves have their right hands cut off. I'm glad to say your father abolished that custom some time ago, and the only minstrel who can safely approach the castle at night is the piper, when he's not plundering villages with firefox." "Good heavens, did I write all this?" thought Fenelio. "I suppose I did."
"Yes, I've heard all that too. What else?"
Cosimo folded his arms over his chest and began pacing up and down, up and down. He really was as beautiful as an angel.
"Perhaps I should have made him a little less beautiful," thought Fenelio. "He looks almost unreal." "What else?" Fenelio frowned. "The Adderhead was always afraid of death, but as he gets older, they say it's become almost an obsession. He is said to spend the night on his knees, sobbing and cursing, shaking with fear that the white women will come for him. They also say that he washes several times a day, for fear of sickness and infection, and he sends envoys to distant lands with chests full of silver to buy him miracle cures for old age. And the women he marries are younger and younger. He hopes that a son will be born to him at long last."
Cosimo had stopped pacing. "Yes," he said softly. "Yes, I have heard all that too, but there are even worse stories. When are you coming to those, or must I tell them myself?"
And before Fenelio could answer, he went on. "They say the Adderhead sends Firefox over the border by night to extort goods from my peasants. They say he claims the whole Wayless Wood for himself. He has my merchants plundered when they come ashore in his harbors, demands high tolls from them for the use of his streets and bridges, and pays footpaths to make my roads unsafe. They say he has the timber for his ships chopped down in my part of the forest and keeps his informers in this castle and in every street in Ombra. They say he even paid my own son to tell him everything my father discussed with his counselors in this hall. And finally," Cosimo paused for effect before he went on, "I am assured that the messenger who warned the fire raisers of my forthcoming attack on them was sent by my father-in-law. I'm told he ate quails covered in silver leaf to celebrate my death, and sent my father a letter of sympathy on parchment so cleverly painted with poison that every character on it was deadly as snake's venom. So do you still wonder why I won't receive him?"
"Poisoned parchment. Good heavens. Who'd think of something like that?" thought Fenelio. "Not I, for one."
"Are you at a loss for words, poet?" asked Cosimo.
"Well, I can tell you I felt the same when I was told all these terrible things. What can one say of such a neighbor? What do you think of the rumor that the Adderhead had my wife's mother poisoned because she liked listening to a minstrel too much? What do you think of his sending Firefox his own men-at-arms as reinforcements to make quite sure that I never returned from the Fire Raiser's fortress? My father-in-law tried to do away with me, poet. I have forgotten a year of my life, and everything before it is as vague in my mind as if someone else had lived it. They say I was dead.
They say the white women took me away. They ask, where have you been, Cosimo? And I don't know the answer. But now I know who wanted my death, and I know who to blame for the way I feel now, empty like a gutted fish, younger than my own son. Tell me, what's the appropriate punishment for crimes of such a monstrous kind against both me and others?
But Fenoglio could only look at him.
Who is he?
He asked himself. For heaven's sake, Fenoglio, you know what he looks like.
But who is he? You tell me,
he replied at last hoarsely.
And Cosimo gave him that angelic smile again. Why, there's only one appropriate punishment, poet, he said. I will go to war.
I'll wage war against my father-in-law until the castle of night is razed to the ground and his name is forgotten.
Fenoglio stood there in the darkened hall, hearing his own blood roaring in his ears.
War? I must have misheard, he thought. I never wrote anything about war.
But a voice began whispering inside him.
A great new age, Fenoglio. Didn't you write something about a great new age?
He has the impudence to ride to my castle with men in his retinue who have already pillaged and burned for Capricorn. He's made Firefox, whom I rode out to defeat, his herald. He sent the piper here as protector of my son. The audacity of it! Perhaps he could deride my father in that way, but not me. I'll show him he's not dealing with a prince who's either shedding tears or overeating now. A faint flush had risen to Cosimo's face. Anger made him even more handsome.
War! Think, Fenoglio. Think. War! Is that what you wanted?
He felt his old knees beginning to tremble. As for Cosimo, he laid his hand almost lovingly on his sword. He slowly drew it from the scabbard.
It was for this alone that death spared me, poet, he said, cutting the air with the long, slender blade. So that I could bring justice to this world and turn the devil himself off his throne. That's worth fighting for, don't you think? Even worth dying for.
He was a fine sight standing there with the drawn sword in his hand. And yes, wasn't he right? Perhaps war was really the only way to put the adder head in his place.
You must help me, Inkweaver. That's what they call you, don't they? I like the name.
Cosimo gracefully sheathed the sword again. Tullio, who was still sitting on the steps at his feet, shuddered as the sharp blade scraped the leather scabbard.
You will write a speech for me, calling my people to arms. You will explain our cause to them. You'll plant enthusiasm for our cause and hatred for our enemy in every heart. And we'll use the strolling players, too. You're a friend of theirs. Write them fiery songs, poet, songs that will make men want to fight. You forge the words. I'll have the swords forged. Many, many swords.
He stood there like an avenging angel, lacking nothing but the wings, and for the very first time in his life, Fenoglio felt something like affection for one of his inky creations.
I'll give him wings, he thought. I will indeed, with my words. Your Highness.
When he bowed his head this time, it wasn't difficult. And for a wonderful moment, he felt almost as if he had written himself the son he never had.
Don't go turning sentimental in your old age,
he told himself, but this warning made no difference to the unaccustomed softening of his heart.
I ought to ride with him, he thought. Yes, indeed. I'll go to war against the Adderhead with him, old as I may be.
Fenoglio, a hero in the world of his own creation, a poet and a warrior, too. It was a role he'd like, as if he had written himself the perfect part to play. Cosimo smiled again. Fenoglio would have bet everything he had that there was no more delightful smile in this or in any other world. Tullio seemed to have succumbed to Cosimo's charm, too, despite the fear the Adderhead had put into his heart. Enchanted, he stared up at the master who had come back to him, his little hands in his lap as if he were still holding the bird with the bloody breast.
"I hear your words already," said Cosimo, returning to the throne. "My wife loves written words, you know.
words that stick to parchment and paper like dead flies. And it seems my father felt the same, but I want to hear words, not read them. Remember that when you're looking for the right words. You must ask yourself what they sound like, glowing with passion, dark with sorrow, sweet with love. That's what I want. Right words quivering with all our righteous anger at the Adderhead's evil deeds, and soon that anger will be in every heart. You will write my accusation, my fiery accusation, and we'll have it read out in every marketplace and spread abroad by the strolling players. Beware, Adderhead! Let it be heard all the way to his own side of the forest. Your wicked days are numbered, and soon every peasant will want to fight under my banner. Every man, young or old, your words will bring them flocking here to the castle. I've heard that when the Adderhead doesn't like what books say, he'll sometimes have them burned in fireplaces of his castle. But how will he burn words that everyone is singing and speaking?
Well, he could always burn the man who speaks them, thought Finolio. Or the man who wrote them.
It was an uncomfortable thought that cooled the ardor of his heart slightly, but Cosimo seemed to have picked it up.
I shall, of course, take you under my personal protection immediately, he said. In future, you will live here at the castle, in apartments suitable for a court poet.
At the castle?
Finolio cleared his throat. So awkward did this offer make him feel.
That's very generous of you. Yes, indeed.
New times were coming. New and wonderful times. A great new age.
You will be a good prince, your grace, he said, his voice much moved. A good and great prince. My songs about you will still be sung in centuries to come, when the Adderhead is long forgotten. I promise you that.
Footsteps sounded behind him. Finolio turned, annoyed by the interruption at such an emotional moment. Violante came hurrying through the hall, holding her son's hand with her maid behind her.
"Cosimo," she cried, "listen to him! Your son wants to say he's sorry!"
Finolio didn't think that Jacopo looked at all sorry. Violante was having to drag him along behind her, and his face was dark as thunder. He didn't seem particularly pleased by his father's return. His mother, on the other hand, was radiant as Finolio had never seen her before, and the mark on her face was not much darker than a shadow cast by the sun.
"The birthmark on her ugliness's face faded. Oh, thank you, Maggie," he thought. "What a pity you're not here."
"I won't say sorry,"
announced Jacopo as his mother propelled him none too gently up the steps to the throne.
"He's the one who ought to say sorry to my grandfather!"
Unobtrusively, Finolio took a step back. Time for him to go. "Do you remember me?" he heard Cosimo ask. "Was I a stern father?" Jacopo merely shrugged. "Oh, yes, you were very stern," her ugliness replied on the child's behalf. "You took away his hounds when he acted like this, and his horse." She was clever, cleverer than Finolio had expected. He went quietly toward the door. It was a good thing he'd soon be living at the castle. He must keep an eye on Violante, or she'd soon be filling the blank of Cosimo's memory to her own liking, as if stuffing a newly prepared turkey. When the servants opened the great door, he saw Cosimo abstractedly smiling at his wife.
"He's grateful to her," thought Finolio. "Grateful to her for filling his emptiness with her words. But he doesn't love her." "And, of course, that's another thing that you never thought of, Finolio," he told himself reproachfully as he walked through the inner courtyard. "Why didn't you write a word about Cosimo loving his wife? Didn't you tell Maggie the story long ago about the flower maiden who gave her heart to the wrong man? What are stories for if we don't learn from them?"
Well, at least Violante loved Cosimo. You only had to look at her to see it. That was something, after all. On the other hand, Violante's maid, the girl with the beautiful hair, Brianna, who Maggie said was Dustfinger's daughter, hadn't she seemed equally enraptured when she looked at Cosimo? And Cosimo himself, hadn't he looked at the maid more often than at his wife?
Never mind, thought Finolio. There'll soon be more important matters at stake than love. Far more important matters.
Chapter 39 another messenger. The Adderhead and his men-at-arms had disappeared when Fenolio came out of the gate of the inner castle.
Good, thought Fenolio. He'll be fuming with rage on his long ride home.
The thought of it made him smile. A number of men were waiting in the outer courtyard. It was easy to guess their trade from their blackened hands, even though no doubt they had scrubbed them thoroughly for their prints. The entire population of Smith's Alley and Ombra seemed to have come up to the castle.
You forge the words! I'll have the swords forged! Many, many swords!
Had Cosimo's preparations for his war begun already?
If so, it's time I set to work on my words, Fenolio told himself.
As he turned into Cobbler's Alley, he thought for a moment that he heard steps behind him. But when he turned, there was only a one-legged beggar hobbling laboriously past him. At every other step, the beggar's crutch slipped in the filth lying among the houses. Pig dung, vegetable refuse, stinking puddles of whatever fluids people tipped out of their windows.
Well, they'll soon be cripples enough, thought Fenolio as he walked on toward Minerva's house. You could call war a cripple factory.
What kind of idea was that? Were doubts of Cosimo's plans stirring in his exhilarated mind? Oh, let it alone.
By all the letters of the alphabet, I'm certainly not going to miss this climb once I'm living in a castle, he thought as he toiled up the stairway to his room. I must remember to ask Cosimo, not on any account, to give me quarters in one of the towers. The climb up to Balbulus' workshop was bad enough.
Oh, so these few steps are too steep for you, but you trust yourself to go to war in your old age, do you?
Said a quiet, mocking voice inside him. It always spoke up at the most inappropriate moments, but Fenolio had plenty of practice in ignoring it. Rosenquartz wasn't there. Presumably he had climbed out of the window again to visit the glass man working for the scribe who lived over on the road in Baker's Alley. The fairies all seemed to have flown away, too. It was quiet in Fenolio's room. Unusually quiet. He sat down on his bed, sighing. He didn't know why, but he couldn't help thinking of his grandchildren and the way they used to fill his house with noise and laughter.
Eh, so what? He thought, feeling angry with himself. Minerva's children make the same kind of noise. And think of how often you've sent them packing down to the yard because it was too much for you.
Footsteps came up the stairs.
Well, speak of the devil.
He didn't feel like telling stories, not at the moment. He had to pack his things and then break the news gently to Minerva that she must look around for a new lodger.
Go away!
He called to whoever it was at the door.
Go and tease the pigs and chickens in the yard. The Inkweaver doesn't have time just now. He's moving to the castle.
The door swung open all the same, but not to reveal two children's faces. A man stood there. A man with a blotched face and slightly protuberant eyes. Fenolio had never seen him before, yet he seemed strangely familiar. His leather trousers were patched and dirty, but the color of his cloak made Fenolio's heart beat faster. It was the Adderhead's silvery gray.
"What's the idea?"
he asked brusquely, getting to his feet, but the stranger was already through the doorway. He stood there with his legs spread, his grin as ugly as his face itself, but it was the sight of his companion that made Fenolio's old knees feel weak. Basta was smiling at him like a long-lost friend. He, too, wore the silver of the Adder Head.
"Bad luck again! Talk about terrible bad luck!"
said Basta, looking around the room.
"Girl's not here. And there we go, stalking you all the way from the castle, quiet as cats, thinking we'd catch two birds with one stone, and now it's just one ugly old raven in our trap."
"Never mind. At least one is something. Can't expect too much of Lady Fortune, can we? After all, she sent you to the castle at just the right time. I recognized your ugly tortoise face at once, but you didn't even see me. Did you?"
No, Fenolio hadn't seen him. Should he have looked closely at every man standing behind the Adderhead?
"Yes, if you'd had your wits about you, Fenolio," he told himself. "That's exactly what you should have done. How could you forget that Basta's back? Wasn't what happened to Mortimer warning enough? Well, what a surprise. Basta, how did you escape the shadow?"
he said out loud, moving unobtrusively backward until he could feel the bed behind him. Ever since a man in the house next door had had his throat cut in his sleep, he had slept with a knife under his pillow, although he wasn't sure if it was still there.
"Sorry, but he must have overlooked me, shut up in that cage as I was," purred Basta in his cat-like voice. "Capricorn wasn't so lucky, but Mortola's still around, and she's told our old friend the Adahead about the three birds we're after. Dangerous sorcerers who kill with words."
Basta slowly came toward Fenolio.
"Who do you think those birds are?"
The other man kicked the door shut with his boot.
"Mortola?"
Fenolio tried to make his voice mocking and supercilious, but it sounded more like the croak of a dying raven.
"Wasn't it Mortola who had you put in a cage to be fed to the shadow?"
Basta just shrugged his shoulders and flung back his silver-gray cloak. Of course he had his knife. A brand new one, it seemed, finer than any he'd ever had in the other world, and undoubtedly just as sharp.
"Yes, not very nice of her," he said as his fingers caressed the handle of his knife. "But she's really sorry. Come on, then. Do you know what birds we're after? Let me help you a little. We've already wrung the neck of one of them, the one that sang the loudest."
Fenolio let himself drop onto the bed without, or so he hoped, any expression on his face.
"I assume you mean Mortimer,"
he said, slowly pushing his hand under the pillow.
"Quite right," Basta smiled. "You should have been there when Mortola shot him, just the way she used to shoot the crows who stole the seed from her fields."
The memory made his smile even nastier. How well Fenolio knew what was going on in his black heart. After all, he had made up Basta, just as he had made up Cosimo and his angelic smile. Basta had always liked describing his own and other people's abominable deeds in detail. His companion didn't seem to be so talkative. He was looking around Fenolio's room with a bored expression. Good thing the glass man wasn't there. It was so easy to smash him.
"But we're not going to shoot you."
Basta came a little closer to Fenolio, his face as intent as that of a stalking cat.
"We'll probably hang you until your tongue is sticking out of your poor old mouth."
"How very imaginative,"
said Fenolio, moving his fingers further and further under the pillow.
"But you know what'll happen then? You'll die too."
Basta's smile disappeared as suddenly as a mouse scurrying into its hole.
"Oh, yes,"
he hissed unpleasantly as his hand instinctively went to the amulet at his throat.
"I almost forgot. You believe you made me up, right? And what about him?"
He pointed to the other man.
"That slasher. Did you make him up too? He sometimes worked for Capricorn after all. Many of the old fire raisers wear the adder's silver now. Although, some of us think it was more fun under Capricorn. All those fine folk in the Castle of Night."
He spat scornfully at Fenolio's feet.
"It's no coincidence that the Adderhead has a snake on his coat of arms. He wants you to crawl on your belly to him. That's what our noble lord and master likes, but never mind, he pays well. Hey, Slasher,"
he addressed his still silent companion, "what do you think? Does this old fella look as if he made you up?" Slasher's ugly face twisted.
"If so, he's made a bad job of it, eh?"
"You're right there," Basta laughed. "I'd say he deserves a taste of our knives just for the face he gave you, right?"
Slasher, yes, indeed. He'd invented Slasher, too. Fenolio felt sick to his stomach when he remembered why he'd given the man that name.
"Out with it, old man!"
Basta leaned so close that Fenolio smelled his peppermint-scented breath. "Where's the girl?
Tell us and we may let you live a little longer. We'll send the child after her father first. I'm sure she's longing to see him. They were so fond of each other, those two. Come on, where is she? Spit it out!"
He slowly drew the knife from his belt. Its blade was long and slightly curved. Finolio swallowed as if to force down his fear. He pushed his hand yet further under the pillow, but all his fingertips met was a piece of bread, probably hidden there by rosin quartz.
Just as well, he thought. What good would a knife have done? Basta would have run me through before he even got a proper hold on it, not to mention Slasher.
He felt the sweat running into his eyes.
Hey, Basta, I know you like the sound of your own voice, but let's get going and take him with us.
Slasher spoke in croaking tones like the toads in the hills by night. Of course that was how Finolio had described him. Slasher, the man with the voice of a toad.
We can question him later. We have to follow the others now,
he urged Basta.
Who knows what this dead prince will do next? Suppose he doesn't let us out of his accursed gate. Suppose he sends his soldiers after us. The others must be miles ahead by now.
With a regretful sigh, Basta put the knife back in his belt. Yes, very well. You're right, he said in surly tones. I need to take my time with this sort of thing. Questioning people is an art. A real art. He roughly seized Finolio's arm, pulled him to his feet, and pushed him toward the door.
Just like old times, eh?
He snarled in his ear.
I took you out of your own house once before, remember? Put on as good an act as you did then, and you'll go on breathing a little longer. And if we pass that woman feeding pigs in the yard, tell her we're taking you to see an old girlfriend of yours. Understand?
Finolio just nodded. Minerva wouldn't believe a word of it. But perhaps she might fetch help. Basta's hand was already on the door handle when footsteps came upstairs again. The old wood creaked and groaned. The children, for heaven's sake. But it was not a child's voice that spoke outside the door.
Inquiva?
Basta cast an anxious glance at Slasher, but Finolio had recognized the voice. It was Cloud Dancer, the former tightrope walker who had brought him messages from the Black Prince many times before. He'd be no help, not with his stiff leg. But what news brought him here? Had the Black Prince heard anything of Meggie? Basta waved Slasher over to the left of the door and stationed himself to the right. Then he gave Finolio a sign and drew the knife from his belt again. Finolio opened the door. It was so low that he always had to duck his head coming in. There stood Clown Dancer, rubbing his knee.
Bloody stairs, he swore, steep and falling apart. I'm just glad you're in and I don't have to climb them again. Here.
He looked around as if the old house had ears and reached into the leather bag that had carried so many letters from place to place.
The girl who's staying with you sends you this.
He held out a piece of paper folded several times. It looked like a page from Maggie's notebook. Maggie hated to tear pages out of a book, and she'd have been reluctant to take one out of this notebook in particular. Her father had bound it for her. So the message must be very important, and Basta would take it for him at once.
Well, here you are, then.
Cloud Dancer impatiently held the folded paper in front of his nose.
Any idea how fast I hurried to bring you this?
Reluctantly, Finolio put out his hand. He knew just one thing. Basta must not see Maggie's message. Never. His finger closed around the paper so tightly that none of it was visible.
And listen,
Cloud Dancer went on quietly. The Adderhead has attacked the secret camp. Dustfinger. Finolio shook his head almost imperceptibly.
Fine, thank you very much, but the fact is, I have visitors just now,
he said, desperately trying to convey what he couldn't say in words with his eyes. He rolled them to the right and to the left as if they could act as fingers pointing to where Basta and Slasher were waiting behind the door. Cloud Dancer took a step back.
Run!
Cried Finolio and leaped out of the doorway. Cloud Dancer almost fell downstairs as Finolio made his way past him, but then he stumbled. Finolio was sliding rather than running down the stairs. He didn't turn until he reached the bottom. He heard Basta cursing behind him and Slasher's croaking voice. He heard the children in the yard screaming with fright, and from somewhere came Minerva's voice. But by then he was running past the sheds and the lines where her freshly washed laundry hung. A pig ran between his legs, making him stumble and fall in the mud, and when he got up, he saw the Cloud Dancer
dancer hadn't been as fast as he was. How could he be with his stiff leg? Boston had taken him by the collar while Slasher pushed Minerva aside as she tried to bar his way with a rake. Finolio ducked down, first behind an empty barrel, then behind the pig's trough, and then crawled over to one of the sheds on all fours. Despina. She was staring at him in astonishment. He laid his fingers on his lips. Shh! Crawled on, forced his way past a couple of planks, and squeezed into the place where Minerva's children had their hideout. He only just fitted in. The place wasn't meant for old men who were beginning to put on weight around the hips. The two children came here when they didn't want to go to bed or weren't keen to work. They hadn't shown their hiding place to anyone but Finolio as proof of friendship and in return for a good ghost story. He heard the cloud dancer scream. He heard Basta roaring something and Minerva weeping. He almost crawled back to them, but fear paralyzed him. And what could he do against Basta's knife and the sword that hung from Slasher's belt? He leaned against the wooden wall of the shed, heard the pigs grunting and rooting about in the ground. Maggie's message swam before his eyes. The sheet of paper was dirty with the mud he'd crawled through, but he could still decipher what she had written.
"I don't know," he heard Cloud Dancer scream. "I don't know what she wrote on it. I can't read."
Brave Cloud Dancer. He probably did know all the same. He usually had people tell him what their messages said.
"But you can tell me where she is, can't you?"
That was Boston's voice.
"Out with it! Is she with Dustfinger? You whispered his name to the old man." "I don't know!" he screamed again,
and Minerva wept louder than ever and shouted for help, her voice echoing back from the narrow houses. "The Adahead's men have taken them all away. My parents and the strolling players," Finolio read. "Dustfinger is following. The spelt mill..." The letters blurred as he looked at them. Yet again he heard screaming out there. He bit his knuckles so hard that they began to bleed. "Write something, Finolio. Save them. Write!" It was as if he could hear Maggie's voice. Another scream. No, no, he couldn't just sit there. He crawled out and on until he could rise up to his feet. Basta was holding Cloud Dancer in a firm grip, pressing him back against the wall of the house. The old tightrope walker's shirt was slit and bloody, and Slasher was standing in front of him with a knife in his hand. Where was Minerva? She was nowhere to be seen, but Despina and Eva were there, in hiding near the sheds, watching what one man could do to another, with a smile on his lips.
"Basta!"
Finolio took a step forward. He put all his rage and all his fear into his voice and held Meggie's close-written sheet of paper up in the air. Basta turned with assumed surprise.
"Oh! There you are!"
he called.
"With the pigs! I might have known it. You better bring us that letter before Slasher finishes slicing up your friend here. You'll have to fetch it yourselves." "And why?"
Slasher laughed.
"You can read it to us, can't you?"
Yes, he could. Finolio stood there at his wit's end. Where were all the lies, the clever lies that usually sprang to his lips so easily? Cloud Dancer was staring at him, his face twisted with pain and fear, and suddenly, as if he couldn't stand the fear a moment longer, he tore himself away from Basta and ran toward Finolio. He ran fast in spite of his stiff knee, but Basta's knife was faster, so much faster. It went straight into Cloud Dancer's back, just as the Adderhead's arrow had pierced the gold mocker's breast. The tightrope walker fell in the mud, and Finolio, standing there, began to tremble. He was trembling so much that Meggie's letter slipped out of his hand and fluttered to the ground, but Cloud Dancer lay there unmoving, his face in the dirt. Despina came out of hiding, hard as Evo tried to haul her back, and stared wide-eyed at the motionless figure lying before Finolio's feet. It was quiet in the yard, very quiet.
"Read it out, scribbler."
Finolio raised his head. Basta stood there in front of him, holding the knife that had been sticking into Cloud Dancer's back just now. Finolio stared at the blood on the bright blade and at Maggie's message in Basta's hand. Without thinking, he clenched his fists.
He struck Basta in the chest as if neither the knife nor Slasher existed.
Basta staggered back, anger and astonishment on his face. He fell over a bucket full of weeds that Minerva had been pulling out of her vegetable plots. Cursing, he got to his feet.
"Don't do that again, old man," he spat. "I'm telling you for the last time, read that out!"
But Finolio had snatched Minerva's pitchfork from the dirty straw piled up outside the pigsty.
"Murderer!"
he whispered, pointing the crudely forged prongs at Basta. What had happened to his voice?
"Murderer! Murderer!" he repeated, louder and louder, and he thrust the pitchfork at the place in Basta's breast where his black heart beat. Basta retreated, his face distorted with rage. Slasher! He roared. Slasher! Come here and get that damn fork away from him!
But Slasher had gone beyond the houses, sword in hand, and was listening. Horses' hooves were clattering along the alley outside.
We must go, Basta! He cried. Cosimo's guards are on their way!
Basta stared at Finolio, his narrowed eyes full of hate.
We'll meet again, old man, he whispered. And next time, you'll be lying in the dirt in front of me, like him.
He stepped heedlessly over the motionless cloud dancer.
As for this, he said, tucking Meggie's letter under his belt, Mortola will read it to me.
Who'd have thought that the fur little bird would write telling us where to find her in her own fair hand? And we'll pick up the fire-eater for free into the bargain.
Come on, quickly, Basta!
Slasher beckoned impatiently.
What are you bothered about? You think they'll string us up because there's one less strolling player in the world?
Replied Basta calmly. But he turned away from Finolio. He waved to him one last time before disappearing among the houses. Finolio thought he heard voices, the clink of weapons, but perhaps it was something else. He kneeled down beside Cloud Dancer and gently turned him on his back, put his ear to his chest, as if he hadn't seen death in his face some moments ago. He sensed the two children coming up beside him. Despina put her hand on his shoulder. It was slim and light as a leaf.
Is he dead?
She whispered.
You can see he is,
said her brother.
Will the white women come fetch him now?
Finolio shook his head. No. He's going to them of his own accord, he answered quietly. You can see that. He's gone already. But they'll welcome him to their white castle. It's built of bones, but very beautiful. There's a courtyard in that castle, full of fragrant flowers, with a tightrope made of moonlight stretched across it just for Cloud Dancer. The words came easily. Beautiful, comforting words. But were they really true? Finolio didn't know. He had never taken any interest in what came after death, either in this world or the other one. Probably just silence. Silence without a single word of comfort. Minerva came stumbling back from the alley, a cut on her forehead. The physician who lived on the corner was with her, and two other women, their faces pale with fear. Despina ran to her mother, but Ivo stayed beside Finolio.
No one would come, Minerva sobbed as she fell to her knees beside the dead man. They were all afraid, every one of them.
Cloud Dancer, murmured the physician.
Bone Knitter, he was often called, Stone Cutter, Piss Prophet, and sometimes when he had lost a patient, Angel of Death.
Only a week ago he was asking if I knew anything that would do the pain in his knee good.
Finolio remembered seeing the physician with the Black Prince. Should he tell him what Cloud Dancer had said about the secret camp? Could he trust him? No. It was better to trust no one. Nothing and no one. The Outerhead had many spies. Finolio straightened up. Never before had he felt so old. So very old that he felt as if he couldn't survive another single day. The mill that Meggie had mentioned in her letter. Where the devil was it? The name sounded familiar. Well, of course it did. He himself had described it in one of the last chapters of Inkheart. The miller was no friend to the Adderhead, even though his mill stood near the Castle of Night in the dark valley south of the Wayless Wood.
Minerva, he asked. How long does it take a mounted man to get from here to the Castle of Night?
2 days for sure, if he's not going to ruin his horse, replied Minerva quietly.
2 days, if not less, before Basta found out what was in Meggie's letter. If he rode to the Castle of Night with it, that was.
But he's sure to do that, thought Finolio. Basta can't read, so he'll take the letter to Mortola, and the magpie is sure to be at the Castle of Night. Yes. There were probably 2 days to go before Mortola would read what Meggie had said and send Basta to the mill, where Meggie might already be waiting.
Finolio sighed. 2 days. Perhaps that would be enough to get a warning to her, but not to write the words she hoped he would send. Words to save her parents.
Write something, Finolio. Write!
As if it were so simple. Meggie, Cosimo, they all wanted words from him.
It was easy for them to talk. You needed time to find the right words, and enough time was exactly what he didn't have.
"Minerva, tell Rosenquartz I have to go to the castle," said Finolio. Suddenly he felt dreadfully tired. "Tell him I'll fetch him later."
Minerva stroked Despina's hair. The girl was sobbing into her skirt and nodded. "Yes, you go to the castle," she said huskily. "Go and tell Cosimo to send soldiers after those murderers. By God, I'll be in the front row to watch them hang."
"Hang? What are you talking about?"
The physician ran a hand through his sparse hair and looked sadly down at the dead man.
"Cloud Dancer is one of the strolling players. No one gets hanged for stabbing a strolling player. It's a harsher penalty for killing a hare in the forest."
Eva looked incredulously at Finolio.
"Will they really not punish him?"
What was he to tell the boy? No, it was a fact. No one would punish them. Perhaps the Black Prince might someday, or the man who had taken to wearing the Blue Jay's mask. But Cosimo wouldn't send a single soldier after Basta. The Motley folk were all outlaws, in Lombrica and Argenta alike, subject to none, protected by none.
"But Cosimo will give me a horseman if I ask him," thought Finolio. "A fast horseman who can warn Meggie of Basta."
"Write something, Finolio. Save them. Write something that will set them all free and kill the Adderhead."
Yes, by God, he would. He'd write rousing songs for Cosimo and powerful words for Meggie, and then her voice could help the story to find a good ending at last.
Chapter 40 No Hope. Luckily, Darius was a good cook, or Orpheus would probably have locked up Eleanor in a cellar again after the very first meal and read himself food to eat out of her books. Thanks to Darius's cooking, however, they were able to spend time upstairs more often, although under the watchful eye of Sugar. For Orpheus liked his food, and plenty of it, and he enjoyed what Darius cooked. Fearing that otherwise Orpheus might let only Darius upstairs, they pretended that Eleanor had concocted all those delicacies with their appetizing aromas, and Darius was just her assistant, tirelessly chopping, stirring, and tasting, but as soon as Sugar, getting bored, left the kitchen to stare at the bookshelves, Darius took over the wooden spoon and Eleanor the chopping. Not that she was much better at chopping than cooking. Now and then some bewildered figure, looking around as if lost, stumbled into the kitchen. Sometimes the visitor was human, sometimes furry or feathered. Once it was even a talking mustard pot. Eleanor could usually work it out from the appearance of each one, which one of her poor books Orpheus had in his pale hands at that moment. Tiny men with old-fashioned hairstyles were presumably from Gulliver's Travels. The mustard pot was very probably from Merlin's cottage, and the enchanting and extremely confused fawn who tripped in one lunchtime on delicate goat's hooves must have come from Narnia. Naturally, Eleanor wondered anxiously if all these creatures were in her library when they didn't happen to be standing glassy-eyed in the kitchen. And finally she asked Darius to go and find out, on the pretext of asking what Orpheus wanted to eat. He came back with the reassuring news that her Holy of Holies was still in dreadful disorder, but apart from Orpheus, his horrible dog, and a rather pale gentleman who looked to Darius suspiciously like the canter of a ghost, no one was pawing, soiling, sniffing, or otherwise damaging Eleanor's books.
"Thank God," she sighed, relieved. "He obviously makes them all disappear again. Must say that appalling man really does know his trade. It looks as if he can read them out of a book by now without making someone else disappear into it."
No doubt about that," remarked Darius, and Eleanor thought she heard a trace of envy in his gentle voice.
"He's a monster all the same,"
she said in a clumsy attempt to console him.
"It's just a pity this house is so well stocked with provisions, or he'd have to send the wardrobe man shopping, and then he'd be alone with the two of us."
As it was, however, days passed by, and there was nothing they could do about either their own imprisonment or the fact that Mortimer and Risa were probably in deadly danger. Eleanor tried not even to think of Meggie. And Orpheus, the one person who could obviously have put everything right with such ease, sat in her library like a pale, fat spider, playing with her books and the characters who populated them, as if they were toys to be taken out and put away again.
"How much longer is he planning to go on like this, I ask myself?"
she said for about the 100th time as Darius was putting rice in the serving dish. Rice cooked just long enough, of course, so it was soft, but the grains were all separate.
Is he planning to keep us cooking and cleaning for him as unpaid servants for the rest of his life, while he amuses himself with my poor books in my house?
Darius did not reply. Instead, and without a word, he piled food onto four plates. This was a meal that certainly wasn't going to send Orpheus out of the house.
Darius!
Whispered Eleanor, putting a hand on his thin shoulder.
Won't you just have a try? I know he always keeps the book close to him, but perhaps we can get our hands on it somehow. You could put something in his food.
He gets sugar to taste everything that he's going to eat.
Yes, I know, right. So we must try something else, anything, and then you can read us into the book. If this repulsive creature won't bring them out for us, then we'll simply go after them.
But Darius shook his head, as he had done every time Eleanor had suggested the same thing, although in slightly different words.
I can't do it, Eleanor,
he whispered, and his glasses clouded over, whether with the steam of cooking or tears rising to his eyes. She thought it better not to inquire.
I've never read anyone into a book, only out of it, and you know what happened then.
Oh, all right. Then read someone here, someone strong and heroic who takes those two out of my house. Who cares if his nose has been flattened or he's lost his voice like Rita, just so long as he has plenty of muscles.
As if on cue, Sugar put his head around the door. Eleanor was constantly amazed to see that it was not much wider than his neck.
Orpheus wants to know where dinner is.
Just ready,
replied Darius, handing him one of the steaming plates.
Rice again,
growled Sugar.
Sorry about that,
said Darius as he pushed past him with Orpheus's plate.
Can you see about the dessert?
Sugar ordered Eleanor as she was about to put the first forkful into her own mouth. No, this just couldn't go on. Acting the kitchen maid in her own house, with a horrible man in her library throwing her books on the floor, treating them like boxes of chocolates, nibbling something from one book here, another there.
There must be a way to do it,
she thought, spooning walnut ice cream into two dishes with a gloomy expression on her face.
There must. There must. Why couldn't her stupid brain work it out?
Chapter 41 The Captives. Night had fallen long ago when Meggie and Farid set out to follow Dustfinger. Go south, keep going south, Cloud Dancer had told them. But how did you know you were going south when there was no sun to show you the way? No stars shining through the black leaves. The darkness seemed to have devoured everything, the trees, even the ground before their feet. Moths fluttered into their faces, attracted by the fire that Farid was nursing in his fingers like a little animal. The trees seemed to have eyes and hands, and the wind carried voices to their ears, soft voices whispering words to Maggie that she didn't understand. On any other night, a point would probably have come when she just stopped or ran back to where Cloud Dancer and Nettle might still be sitting by the fire. But tonight, she knew only that she must find Dustfinger and her parents. For neither night nor the forest could hold any terrors for her greater than the fear that had taken root in her heart when she saw Moe's blood on the straw. At first, and with the fire to help him, Farid kept finding traces, a print left by one of Dustfinger's boots, a broken twig, a marten's trail. But the time came when he stood there at a loss, not sure which way to go. Tree grew beside tree in the pale moonlight whichever way you looked, so close together you couldn't make out any path between their trunks. And Maggie saw eyes. Eyes above her, behind her, beside her. Hungry eyes, angry eyes. So many of them she wished the moon wouldn't shine so brightly through the leaves.
Farid, she whispered, let's climb a tree and wait for sunrise. We'll never find Dustfinger's trail again if we just go on like this.
My own opinion exactly. Dustfinger appeared among the trees without a sound, as if he had been standing there for some time already.
I've been able to hear you plowing through the forest behind me like I heard a wild boar for the last hour, he said, as Jink pushed past his legs. This is the wayless wood, and not the safest part of it either. You can think yourselves lucky I managed to convince the elves in the ash trees that you weren't breaking their branches just for fun. How about the nightmares? Do you think they don't pick up your scent?
If I hadn't sent them packing, you'd probably be lying stiff as dead wood among the trees by now, caught in bad dreams like two flies in a spider's web.
Nightmares? Whispered Farid, as the sparks at his fingertips went out.
Nightmares. Maggie came closer to him. She was remembering a story that Risa had told her. What a good thing it hadn't come into her mind earlier.
Yes. Did I never tell you about them?
Jink ran to Dustfinger as he walked toward them and greeted Gwyn with a delighted chatter.
They may not eat you alive like those desert ghosts you kept telling me about, but they're not exactly friendly either.
I'm not going back, said Maggie, looking at him resolutely. Whatever you say, I'm not going back.
Dustfinger looked at her.
No, I know, he said. Your mother all over.
That was all.
All night they followed the broad track left by the men-at-arms as they had marched through the forest. All night, and the following day. Dustfinger let them stop for a brief rest only when he saw that Maggie was staggering with exhaustion. When the sun was once again so low in the sky that it touched the treetops, they reached the crest of a hill, and Maggie saw the dark ribbon of a road running through the green of the forest down below. A collection of buildings stood beside it, a long, low house with stables around a yard.
The only inn close to the border, Dustfinger whispered to them. They probably left their horses there. You can move considerably faster on foot in the forest. Everyone who wants to go south and down to the sea stops to rest at this inn. Couriers, traders, even a few of the strolling players, though everyone knows that the landlord is one of the Arrowhead's spies. If we're lucky, we'll be there before the party we're following, because they won't be able to get down the slopes with the handcart and the prisoners. They'll have to go the long way round, but we can take the direct route and wait for them at the inn.
And then what?
For a moment, Maggie thought she saw the same anxiety in his eyes that had driven her into the woods by night. But who was he anxious about? The Black Prince? The other strolling players? Her mother? She still clearly remembered that day in Capricorn's crypt, when he had begged Risa to escape with him and leave her daughter behind. Perhaps Dustfinger had remembered it, too.
Why are you looking at me like that?
He asked.
Oh, it's nothing. She murmured, bending her head. I'm just worried.
And for good reason, he said, abruptly turning his back on her.
But what are we going to do when we've caught up with them?
Freed was hurrying unsteadily after him.
I don't know,
was all Dustfinger said as he began looking for a way down the slope, keeping in the cover of the trees. I thought one of you might have some ideas since you were so keen to come along.
The route he took led downhill so steeply that Maggie could hardly keep her footing, but then she suddenly saw the road, stony and rutted with channels where water had once flowed down from the hills. On the other side were the stables and the house she had seen from the top of the hill. Dustfinger waved her over to a place by the roadside where the undergrowth would shield her from curious eyes.
No, they don't seem to be here yet, but they must arrive soon, he said quietly. They may even stay the night, fill their bellies, get drunk to forget the terrors of the forest. Can't show my face over there while it's still light. Given my luck, one of Capricorn's fire-raisers who's now working for the Arrowhead will cross my path.
But you, he said, placing a hand on Farid's shoulder, you can go over there safely. If anyone asks where you're from, just say your master's sitting in the inn drinking. Count the soldiers. Count the prisoners, and see how many children are among them. Understand, meanwhile, I'll take a look further along the road. I have a kind of idea. Freed nodded and lured Gwyn over to him.
I'll go with him.
Meg expected Dustfinger to forbid her to go with Farid, but he just shrugged his shoulders.
As you like, I can't keep you here. I just hope your mother doesn't give herself away when she recognizes you. And another thing.
He took hold of Maggie's arm as she was about to follow Farid.
Don't get it into your head that we can do anything for your parents. Perhaps we can free the children, even a few of the adults if they run fast enough, but your father won't be able to run, and your mother will stay with him. She won't leave him on his own any more than she would have left you behind that other time. We both remember it, don't we?
Maggie nodded and turned her face away so that he wouldn't see her tears, but Dustfinger gently turned her around and wiped them from her cheeks.
You really are like your mother, he said softly. She never wanted anyone to see her cry either, however good her reasons for tears.
His face looked strained as he scrutinized the two of them again.
Well, you're dirty enough, he commented. Anyone would take you for a stable boy and a kitchen maid,
We'll meet behind the stables as soon as it's dark. Now, off you go.
They didn't have long to wait. Meggy and Farid had been hanging around the stables for barely an hour when they saw the procession of prisoners come down the road. Women, children, old men, hands tied behind their backs, and soldiers on both sides of them. These men were not armed, no helmets hid their sullen features, but they all wore their master's snake emblem on their breasts.